I'm Francie Rosner, and I'll be talking about work that I did at the University of Washington with Yoshi Kono and David Weatherall on detecting and defending against third-party tracking on the web. So first, what do we mean by third-party web tracking? So consider a user browsing the web. Maybe he visits the New York Times, and then Facebook, and so on. And some of these sites might include third-party content like advertisements. When the user's browser loads these advertisements, it makes requests to the third party, advertise.com in this example, and that reveals information about the user to that third party. So in this case, advertise.com now knows that the same user visited both the New York Times and CNN. All of this happened without the user's knowledge, so the user didn't click on any of the advertisements or visit advertise.com directly. And we refer to this list of sites that link a particular user as a browsing profile. So different websites might include different third-party content, and those third parties can then create different browsing profiles of the user. And some websites might include content from sites that the user ordinarily visits directly. So for example, Facebook exposes the like button, which is included by many websites, and this button allows Facebook to create the same kind of browsing profile. Now, these third parties can use these browsing profiles to provide valuable functionality. So they can better target advertisements, they can provide analytics services to the websites that embed them, and they can display personalized content to users. But from the user's perspective, a larger browsing profile can spell reduced privacy because a party of which the user may not even be aware is gathering information about the user's browsing behavior. So there's been a lot of discussion about web tracking in recent years, both in the media and in the research community. But as we started digging into this issue, we discovered that, in general, there is limited understanding of how tracking actually works, and in particular, how different mechanisms used by trackers translate to different capabilities. So our goals in this work are to understand the tracking ecosystem, how tracking is actually done in the wild, and how different mechanisms used by trackers translate to different types of profiles that they can create about users. We're also interested in how effective defenses are that are available to users today, and we identify some gaps with those defenses, and we'll address some of those gaps with a new defense, a browser extension that we call ShareMeNot, which I'll describe later in this talk. So in the first part of this talk, I'll dig into how tracking actually works, both the mechanisms used by trackers and a taxonomy that we developed to help us understand the complex space of tracking behavior. And then I'll describe a measurement study we did based on that taxonomy, and finally I'll focus on defenses. So the trackers that we consider in this work require two capabilities. One is the ability to store the user's identity on the client side. So this is usually some sort of unique identifier for the user. It may or may not be anonymous. And generally it's stored on the client side in a browser cookie, but trackers can also use HTML5 local storage or flash cookies. These are the three we focus on, although trackers might also use other more exotic storage mechanisms. We also don't focus on stateless trackers, so trackers that might try to use fingerprinting techniques to re-identify the user based on browser characteristics. The second thing these trackers need to be able to do is communicate this information back to themselves. So in particular, they need to communicate back the visited page as well as the user's identifier. Generally, this is done automatically by the browser, which includes cookies with the requests and HTTP refer information, but trackers can also use JavaScript to mine this information and send it back to themselves or another party explicitly. So if we look at how tracking works in the simple case, we can sort of broadly consider two categories, within-site tracking and cross-site tracking. So on a given site, when a user visits that site, it can use browser cookies or other client-side state to track repeat visits to that same website. So we call these first-party cookies because they're set by the website visited directly by the user. And these are used commonly on the web to support login and shopping carts and so on. Now, when a website embeds content from a third party, and this content sets a cookie, we call this a third-party cookie, and this is what will actually enable a tracker to create a cross-site profile, not just a within-site profile. So if we look in detail at how this works, we have the user's browser on the left here and tracker.com's server on the right, and let's suppose that the user visits site1.com, and that site1.com includes an iframe with an ad from tracker.com. When the user's browser goes to load this ad, it makes a request to tracker.com, which returns the ad and also a browser cookie containing some kind of unique identifier. So that will be stored in a user's browser. And again, this is a third-party cookie, and it's only accessible to tracker.com. So now tracker.com can link this identifier with the visited site. And if the user later visits another site, like site2.com, if it includes the same tracker, the request to that tracker will now automatically include the cookie with that identifier. So now tracker.com can link these two visits and start creating this cross-site browsing profile for the user. So it may seem like this is fairly simple with these two categories, but in reality, the space of tracking behavior is much more complicated than this. So I'm going to spend the next part of the talk describing a taxonomy that we developed to help us understand how different mechanisms that trackers use can result in different capabilities. So these two categories are the ones that I've already talked about, the simple cases. So in the within site tracking case, in recent years it's become popular for websites to actually embed third-party analytics libraries instead of doing their own on-site tracking. So Google Analytics is a popular example of this. And the way that these work is they set first-party cookies on the domains of the websites that embed them. So these first-party cookies allow them only to track the user on that given site and not create this kind of cross-site browsing profile that the other trackers I'll describe can do. And generally, you'll notice that I've been saying browser cookies, but this taxonomy applies to any kind of client-side state. Browser cookies just happen to be the most popular way to do this. So this standard cross-site tracker, the simple case, we call vanilla behavior. And a common defense for this is to disable third-party cookies. In practice, we've seen a variety of behaviors, mechanisms that trackers can use to circumvent third-party cookie blocking. And so this leads us to a tracking behavior that we call forced tracking. So I'll describe how this works. To understand this, you need to understand some of the quirks of third-party cookie blocking. So when a user blocks third-party cookies on any browser, that means that a third party will not be able to set a cookie. However, on most browsers other than Firefox, once a cookie has been set, it will still be sent by the browser, even if the request is a third-party request. So as a result, if a tracker is ever able to set a cookie in under other circumstances, it can then use it as a third-party cookie later. So let's look at how this works in detail. Again, we have the user's browser on the left, and the user visits site1.com, which includes tracker.com just as before. But now, when tracker.com tries to set a cookie, it will fail if the user's blocked third-party cookies. Now, if the tracker is able to somehow maneuver itself into a first-party position in order to set a cookie, such as by opening a pop-up, now the browser will let it set that cookie because it's in a first-party position. So from this point, the tracker can continue to track on most browsers just as it did before circumventing third-party cookie blocking. So in particular, the cookie will get attached to the request, and the tracker will be able to link these two visits to the same user. And you'll notice that in the second case, the tracker didn't need to open the pop-up again. If it had already set that cookie, it can continue to use it. So again, if a tracker can ever set a cookie, in most browsers, that means it can continue to track just as in the vanilla case. So I've described these behaviors sort of in isolation so far, but we saw a lot of cases where trackers actually coordinate with each other. In particular, we saw complex ad networks where one website might include one tracker, one ad aggregator that would make multiple explicit requests to a bunch of other third parties. So if we look at how this works, the user again visits site1.com, which has our usual green tracker.com here, which sets its third-party cookie. But now it does an additional thing, which is sends an explicit request to othertracker.com. And this request includes all the information that othertracker.com needs to be able to create its own cross-site browsing profile for the user. So that includes the user's identifier and the visited site. If this is now the same interaction on another site, so site2.com, and the same information is passed, now othertracker.com can create the same kind of browsing profile as tracker.com. And you'll notice that othertracker.com never needed to set any of its own client-side state, essentially because it was piggybacking on tracker.com, it was able to create the same kind of browsing profile without any of its own state. So finally, we've seen with the rise of social networks, this last category in our taxonomy, which we call personal tracking. You may be familiar with some of these buttons. So these are social widgets that websites can embed in order to let users share information back to their Facebook page or their Google Plus page. So just like all of the other trackers I've described, these buttons will allow the tracker to create a browsing profile of the user just by being loaded. So there's two differences in this category to the others. The first is that users visit these sites directly, explicitly. So a particular user might not ordinarily visit, you know, advertise.com, but he probably does visit Facebook. And in doing so, he'll pick up a first-party cookie from Facebook directly, thereby circumventing third-party cookie blocking in the same way as I described with the forced behavior. Perhaps more importantly, this tracking is often not anonymous because users are logged into accounts on these websites like Facebook and Google. So these trackers, in addition to creating the browsing profile, are able to link that information with other information that the user might have entered into their account. So that concludes all of the behaviors in our taxonomy. I've described them separately, but in practice, trackers can exhibit more than one of these behaviors at a time. And broadly, the taxonomy splits trackers based on the scope of the browsing profile, so within site or cross-site tracking. But we've also distinguished these different types of cross-site trackers by their mechanisms. And these distinctions are important because they'll have different implications for how we can detect and defend against these trackers. In the measurement section coming up, I'll often clump these three together and call them anonymous trackers, and then call out the personal trackers explicitly. So now I'll describe our measurement study. We did our measurements with a tool we developed called Tracking Tracker, which is a Firefox add-on. And it's based on the taxonomy that we developed, so it detects the different mechanisms used by the trackers, and then crawls the web, automatically detecting the tracking behavior and labeling the trackers according to the behavior it sees. So it monitors third-party requests, and it also looks at all browser cookies, HTML5 local storage, and flash cookies. And it also looks at identifier leaks. So that means that we look at not just third-party cookies in isolation, but whether any of the unique values in third-party cookies are actually leaked to other parties. So without that, we can't detect, for example, referred trackers where one party sets a cookie but then sends that information to someone else. So we did our measurement study with three data sets, the Alexa top 500 sites, as well as 500 sites not in the top set. And we looked at five pages on each of these domains. So we looked at the main page and up to four within domain links on that page if there were that many. But of course, what we're really interested in is the browsing profiles for users. So to approximate user browsing behavior, we used the AOL search logs. And so we picked 35 random users from those logs, took 300 unique queries for each user, and then executed those queries and took the top search result as a page for the browsing history of this hypothetical user. So we end up with 35 sets of up to 300 unique pages. So the first thing you might be interested in is how prevalent is this tracking behavior in this data set? So on the 500 domains, we found 524 unique trackers. And this graph shows how many trackers there are on a domain. So one data point on this graph shows what percentage of sites had at least that many trackers. So for example, 100% of sites had zero or more trackers on them. 91% of sites had at least one tracker. And most of these sites actually had at least one cross-site tracker. So that means that most of these sites aren't just including Google Analytics to do within site tracking, but they're actually including trackers that can create these cross-site profiles. If we look in the middle, half of the domains embed between four and five trackers. And in the extreme case, we saw one domain that included 43 unique trackers. This graph shows the 20 most prevalent trackers that we saw. So the numbers here indicate on how many of the 500 domains we found this tracker. So for example, we found Google analytics on 297 of the top 500 domains. And the colors of these bars show the different tracking behaviors that we categorized. So Google Analytics is very popular. It's the only within-site tracker in the top 20. The rest are all cross-site trackers. And like I said, I've distinguished them as personal or anonymous tracking. The personal ones are the black bars. And you can see that Facebook and Google there are the most popular personal trackers here. And you'll notice that there's a couple of very popular trackers on these sites and then a very long tail of less popular trackers. Now, if we look at the browsing profiles for our hypothetical AOL users, one of these lines on this graph represents one user, and one data point for a tracker is on how many of the sites in the user's browsing history was that tracker found. So for example, we found DoubleClick, which is Google's ad network, on an average of 39% of the pages visited by our hypothetical users, in the maximum case on 2/3 of one of those users' pages. Facebook and Google are also very popular, so they're on an average of 23 and 21% of the pages visited by these users. So for a privacy-conscious user, these might be alarmingly large percentages of the browsing behavior that they're leaking to these third parties. I mentioned that we also looked at local storage and flash cookies, and we found surprisingly little use of these mechanisms compared to what we were expecting. So most trackers by far use regular browser cookies. So of the 524 trackers we saw, only 5 set unique identifiers in local storage and 35 set unique identifiers in flash. So when there's an identifier stored in 2 locations, we have the threat of respawning. So if a user clears their browser cookies, for example, the tracker can repopulate that value if it's also stored that value in a flash cookie or local storage. So we looked for this kind of behavior, and we looked in both directions. So clearing browser cookies and looking for respawning from local storage in flash, and vice versa. And we saw some of this behavior, but maybe not really as much as we would have expected. So finally, I'll focus on defenses. In the paper, we describe a number of defenses, both from a theoretical perspective and a measurement perspective. So we look at the do not track header, we look at clearing client-side state, and I encourage you to look at our paper to see the details of these. In this talk, I'm just going to focus on third-party cookie blocking because it will lead us to our new defense. So this graph is the same graph that I showed you before, which is the top 20 trackers in the data set. And this is without any defenses enabled. So in particular, third-party cookies are not blocked. And if we block third-party cookies, what we'll expect to see is that many of these cross-site trackers will go away. And so this is what we see when we block third-party cookies. And if we scoot those over and see our new top 20 set, this is what we have. So you can see that now the black bars, the personal trackers, dominate. And if you'll recall, this is because users go to these sites directly to pick up cookies, so third-party cookie blocking is not effective. We did measure this in Firefox, but we measured these results as though it were another browser. So what I mean is that if there was a third-party cookie present, we counted it, even if Firefox wouldn't actually include that with the request, other browsers would. So you'll see that there are still two of these anonymous trackers left. So we can look at why these are there. AddThisCDN.com is a referred tracker, so it doesn't rely on any of its own state. It relies on state from AddThis.com, which refers it in explicitly to AddThisCDN. So because AddThis was not affected by third-party cookie blocking, neither was this referred tracker. And here we have one that is a forced tracker, so it actually opens a pop-up window and sets a first-party cookie. So it's also not affected by third-party cookie blocking once it's set that cookie once. So as you saw in that graph, the most popular trackers that remain are these personal trackers. And our data show that the most popular ones are sort of the likely suspects, so they're the ones that expose these social widgets like Facebook, Google, Twitter, and so on. And as I've discussed, third-party cookie blocking is ineffective for these. And in fact, in Firefox, with its stricter third-party cookie blocking policy, these buttons are broken. So users can't use them if they do actually want to click the like button and share something back to their Facebook page, for example. There are existing solutions to deal with these buttons. but they generally remove the buttons entirely from the web experience, which may be undesirable to some users that actually want to click on the buttons. So our question was, can we actually have both? Can we both prevent tracking when users are not clicking on the buttons, but allow the buttons to work when users want to click on them? So we developed ShareMeNot, which is a browser extension that does just this. So it allows users to click on the buttons when they want to, but prevents tracking when they don't click on the buttons. The Firefox version that we describe in the paper works simply by removing third-party cookies from these requests until the user clicks on the button. And then necessarily it needs to reattach the cookie to let the transaction continue as usual. And the related Priv3 Firefox add-on works in a similar way. The weakness of this general mechanism is that even though there are no longer cookies attached to the requests, those requests are still made to the third party, potentially revealing the user's IP address and so on. So we've recently developed a Chrome version which addresses this weakness by replacing the buttons entirely with local versions of the buttons. So no requests are made at all to the trackers until the user clicks on one of the local buttons. And then depending on the complexity of the interaction, ShareMeNot will either make the request directly to tweet the page, for example, or it will reload with the real button. So we're working on updating the Firefox version to match this more privacy-preserving design. So we also measured the effectiveness of ShareMeNot on the top 500 sites. So the middle column is no defenses, and the right is ShareMeNot. So you can see it's very effective for preventing tracking by these various social trackers when the user's not clicking on them. And you'll notice that there are few that remain for Facebook and Google. And this is a result of the way that ShareMeNot works. In order not to break Facebook.com when the user visits it directly, it uses a blacklist, and that doesn't fully support some of the more complicated Facebook social plugin, like the comments widget and things like that yet. So in this talk, I've described a taxonomy of tracking behavior that's applicable to any client-side identifiers. And we use that taxonomy to do a measurement study of tracking in the wild. This measurement study revealed a rich tracking ecosystem. And in general, we hope that the results from this study, as well as our tracking taxonomy, can help inform broader discussions of web tracking, both in the policy space and the technical space, as people try to figure out how we can balance the benefits of the information gathered with tracking with the privacy concerns. So along those lines, we developed ShareMeNot, which is a new privacy-enhancing defense that protects users from these personal trackers while still allowing them to use the buttons when they want to. And I've put the URL for ShareMeNot on this slide if you're interested in checking it out. And with that, I thank you for your attention so early in the morning.
Okay, Vyas from Intel Labs. I had two questions. One is on your slides 18 and 19. You say there's like 524 unique trackers, but a lot of these are essentially from the same administrative domain. Like you say Google API, Google Analytics are the same thing. And I remember the study from Bala that essentially showed that a lot of them are actually sort of the same administrative domain. I was curious how many of those 524 are actually distinct administrative domains?
That's a good question. So we didn't actually look at which ones were actually owned by the same party. And so I don't know about which ones belong to the same one. It is true that some of them probably do belong to the same administrator, but we don't know from the client side, we can't tell what kind of information they share on the back end. So for example, Google Analytics is very careful to only be a within-site tracker. It uses its own domain, it only sets first-party cookies. So from the client side, what we can see, it's only a within-site tracker. Whether or not that information is shared on the back end, we don't really know.
Can I ask one more question? Okay, thanks. So second question is, have you actually compared ShareMeNot with things like NoScript or AdBlock? How much do they block? What sort of add-on does value add does ShareMeNot give me beyond just running NoScript or AdBlock?
So I haven't compared directly to those. So the way I understand those working is that they actually block these requests if you want to block them. So that means that actually the buttons won't even load. So if the user wants to click on one of the buttons, they won't be able to. And the goal of ShareMeNot is to basically serve those users that do sometimes want to click but usually don't want to be tracked.
Okay, thanks.
Aaron Gember, University of Wisconsin. So are there other side channels besides cookies that you discovered in building this really interesting taxonomy that trackers can use? I'm thinking they're going to send a request for an ad image, and now they have like your IP address. Is that another useful way that they do this tracking at all?
Yes. So one of the major ways of tracking that we didn't look at, so we only looked at trackers that actually set state on the client side. But trackers can also use fingerprinting techniques to re-identify users. So they can look at IP address, of course, is a big one, but also things like browser screen resolution and stuff like that. So they can use that to re-identify users. We only looked at we looked at local storage, browser cookies, and flash cookies, and then we looked for leaks of those. But we didn't look more at what kind of information is otherwise leaked in the requests.
Saikat Guha, Microsoft Research India. Do you have a sense of why publishers are embedding 43-odd trackers on a page? I mean, is there a lot of money in this? And if there's money in this, would they not, once these defenses are in place, try to obviously circumvent them or even go to the extreme of booting the user off of their system if they can not no longer monetize the user?
Yep, that's a good question. So I think that most of the sites that have a large number of trackers on them, actually these are these ad networks. So a website might include a couple trackers, and these will, depending on what kind of ads they're loading, you know, maybe what kind of targeting they're doing, they'll request different third-party content. So I think that's the main reason that there's a bunch of these trackers. In terms of circumventing the defenses, I think that the real approach moving forward is to essentially try to get both. So presumably there's a large privacy gain that you can get by designing these things differently while getting a small functionality loss for these things.
My name's John Dunnigan, I'm at Amazon. I want to follow up on the comment you made earlier about how you're not checking whether sites exchange information on the back end to do correlation. And this, when I was thinking about this, this sounded to me like a reason to actually not try to approach this problem through technical means, and if anything, to adopt only pursue it through legislative means. Really, it seems like sites will continue to be able to identify users on through first-party tracking, and if it's valuable to them, they can easily correlate that on the back end. So why is this the right technical direction, trying to prevent this kind of correlation at the client side?
So that's a good question, and I definitely agree that this is going to be largely a policy discussion. So on the client side, especially today, having these defenses gives users control of their data. So users, if they're made aware of this and if they care about it, they can do something on their own browser to protect themselves. Moving forward, I think you're right that we can lock down all the things on the client side and trackers will still be able to do this correlation on the back end. And I think you're right that policy is probably the right solution there.
Thank you.
Thanks, Francie. And